Welcome to the Echo Community Church Podcast. At Echo, we're all about being and making disciples of Jesus Christ. And on this podcast, you'll hear solid teaching from the Bible from our pastors at Echo. Thanks for checking us out and enjoy the message.
We have been studying through the entire book of Genesis a chapter at a time. About 75% of our Sundays over the course of the year, we pick a book and we go through it a chapter at a time. That keeps me accountable and our teaching team accountable to make sure we're not just picking a few parts of the Bible, but that we're, if you stay here long enough, you'll get through the whole Bible. And we're making good progress between Sundays and Wednesdays. We're making good progress. Genesis just happens to be a lengthy book, right? It's 50 chapters long. That's a lot of chapters. But it's you know, it's an origin story. It is the Bible's revelation of where we came from, what went wrong, and what God did about it. It's a book of beginnings. And so the Bible's not just an ice, you know, it's not just 66 individual books that don't have a connection. Those 66 books tell one overarching story about where we came from, what went wrong, what God did about it, how Jesus made it all right, and how it works out in the end. That's the narrative arc of the whole Bible. Now, we get through the first couple parts pretty quick. Like, the first couple chapters, like, you get two chapters on the origin of the universe, and now we're in a part where we get 14 chapters on a guy named Joseph. And I've told you before, if it was up to me to allocate the content of the first book, I'd be like, give me 16 chapters on where the world came from, and maybe a paragraph on this other dude with the fancy coat. But just by allocation alone, it tells me that even though a lot of us might be experiencing Genesis fatigue, which is more my fault than Genesis's fault, if the Bible's boring, it's my fault. It's not the Bible's fault. God at least is just saying, I'm going to give you like 7x the information in this book on this one guy. I think you need to look into his life. There's a lot there. So the Bible's not primarily trying to be a science book, although it does give us a little bit of science here and there. It's telling us a big story about where we came from, what went wrong, what God plans to do about it. So if you allow me to draw a very crude, I was going to try and call it a family tree. It's not. But I also recognize that if we're accomplishing what we hope to accomplish as a church, there's a lot of you here this morning that might be intimidated by the Bible because it's not very familiar to you. I'm glad you're here. We were hoping you'd be here. And so to that reason, give me 2 or 3 minutes to give you the background of what we're about to read, or you might feel like you're parachuting into the middle of a story where you don't know the characters, like that you started the movie a third of the way in, and I want to make sure that I get there. What goes wrong? God created us to be with him, period. He wanted to be inseparable with us. He wanted us to enjoy being with him, to share all that we are with him, and he wanted us to enjoy him and him to enjoy us. That was the plan, to be totally inseparable. That didn't last long in terms of the content of the Bible because mankind said, we want to be with God and at the same time, we want to do things the way we feel is best. And this desire to reject, to not relate to God like he created us, but relate it to us as like an option or a peer, and to think that maybe my way is better than his, even though he says this, that doesn't quite feel right to me, I'd like to go with this, that's called sin. And this desire to not relate to God as creator, to not relate to him as Lord, but to prefer being who we want to be rather than he wants us to be, that's in all of us, and that's called sin. And that's a problem because the Bible says sin separates us from God because he can't be part of it. Well, that thickens the plot like 3 chapters into the Bible. So God makes man, and the first 2 human beings say, well, we don't really want to relate to you that way. And so now we're separated. We're not inseparable. We're separated. And that's the tension of the whole Bible. What does God do about the separation? Does he say, you know what, I never should have made him. Let me just ball him up like a rough draft and throw it in the trash can and move on. That would have been the easier thing to do. He does the harder thing. He says, I'll buy them back. I'll make them so they're rightfully mine anyway because I created them. And if you create something, you get the right to name it. And this is why we don't crowdsource the name of our children. It's like, no, we made the kid. We're going to name the kid what we name the kid, right? It makes sense with us that way, but we don't apply that to God. Well, how dare he? Well, if he is really the creator, then it's not a dare. That's just how it works. It's creator's privilege, right? He makes us. If you believe that he's a loving God, he makes us. And he gives us, you know, boundaries to live inside so that that's where the blessing and the favor and the joy and the enjoyment is. And so he He says, I'll buy them back, but there's still, I'm a just God, so I can't just sweep this under the rug. A good judge doesn't see a convicted criminal and say, you know what, I'm just having a great day today. I'm just going to let you off the hook. There's no punishment. Yeah, you murdered all these people, but I'm going to let you off. We'd say that judge is unjust. You don't just sweep crimes under the rug. And you don't say you're guilty, but that doesn't make a judge just. So God, to be a just judge, can't just sweep our sin under the rug. So he says, his strategy is, I'll allow a substitutionary sacrifice. Someone else can be the substitute for the guilty, but that person can't be guilty. And he figured out pretty quick, there's no human candidate that's going to survive this. Every possible human candidate showed, hey, we're ineligible. So God tells us, I'm going to have to send somebody from outside the world, because there's no candidate on the world. If I'm going to be able to find a substitute, I'm going to have to send them from outside the world into the world. And then they're going to have to succeed in the mission. And that person, we learn later on, is Jesus Christ. So he makes a promise to one man in Genesis. Father Abraham. He makes a promise to Father Abraham, and he says, Abraham, I'm not going to write off humanity. I'm going to save the whole world through you and through your descendants. And at this time, Abraham has no children. He says, I'm going to give you a son. And that son's going to have sons. And out of all those sons are going to come a big family. And out of that family is going to come a big nation. And out of that big nation is going to come a king, the Messiah. And that one king is going to save everyone forever. That's the plot of how God is going to make things right. He's going to send someone from outside the world into the world as a person that's fully human and fully divine, and it's going to come through the descendants of this man. And he says, Abraham, that's the covenant that I make with you. I'm true, and I'll be true to my word. And here's what I want you to do, Abraham. I want you to know me. I want you to walk before me. I want you to enjoy being together with me. I want you to do right by this covenant and honor the covenant, and I want you to teach your kids my ways. That's what I want you to do. Now, who gets the better end of the deal here? Obviously, Abraham. God gets Abraham. Abraham gets all this. And I ask this all the time. God, how is it in this deal between you and me? Like, who gets the better end of the deal? Easy. I do. I get my relationship with God and with his son, Jesus. I get his Holy Spirit living inside of me. I get durable peace. I get a rock solid identity. I get a purpose. I get to enjoy God's presence with me. I get to be able to have all the fear of death and the afterlife squeezed out of my life. I could go on, but I mean, that's a pretty good starter set. That's a good benefits package. That's what I get out of this. He gets me. Broken, flawed, half-bearded, balded me. That's what he gets. Have you ever marveled at that? Like, in this great exchange, like, what does God get out of this? And yet, when you read the Bible, God is trying to convince us that he gets the better end of the deal. Only God loves like that. Only God loves like that. So, he says to Abraham, I'm going to give you kids. And so we'll expedite, because this is the whole history of Genesis. So Father Abraham has, you got it. A few of you went to Sunday school. He has many sons. Those of you who don't know, it's okay. We won't teach it. I'm not going to sing. He actually has sons to three different women. We've covered all that history. But one of them ends up being God's choice to carry on the promise. Doesn't mean he doesn't love the other one. Doesn't mean he didn't have a plan for the other ones. But Isaac, right? Isaac has two boys. He has Esau and who else? Jacob. All right. Now, out of those two boys, who did the culture say would be the son of the promise? But who ends up being the son of the promise? Jacob. Jacob, who also was renamed Israel. Yeah. Now, let's be honest. When you really read through these stories like we have, is he a completely moral example that we should follow everything about marriage and parenting? No. What about this guy? This guy? This guy? No. You seeing a pattern here? The Bible is not primarily a collection of perfectly moral human beings that we should just follow their example and God will love us. Because where are they? There's only one, Jesus. All the rest of these people are broken and flawed just like us, and yet in spite of their brokenness and flaws, God's grace breaks in and saves them from the sin and the corruption that would normally sink them. Okay. Now, Jacob, what a mess. Okay, so Jacob, right? A lot of women he has kids with, right? He has four women he has kids with. And of those four, let's just go to this one. And of that one, he has four boys. And the youngest of those is a man by the name of Judah. Now, those of you that have a little more Bible understanding, Jesus is referred to by a lot of different names. One of the names Jesus is referred to is he is the lion from the tribe of Judah. So today, we're going to meet Judah. And we're going to meet Judah's three boys that he has. He has a boy named he has a boy named Onan, and he has a boy named Shelah. So here's the deal. If this is indeed God's strategy that the promise has passed from Abraham to Isaac to Jacob to Judah, in order for the promise to keep going along, in practical terms, Judah has to have sons. Well, he has three. Now, of those three sons, the one that got, you know, for the promise to keep moving along, one of those three sons has to have at least one son. Or else, Jesus doesn't come into the world. Do you see what I'm saying? Okay. All right. Now, with that in mind, let me read to you the passage in our sermon today titled Breakdowns and Breakthroughs. You're going to see a whole lot of breakdowns here, but you're also going to see three breakthroughs. Trust me, if I could have picked originally a chapter, if you gave me one skip for all the chapters in Genesis, this would have probably been there. Those of you that knew we were teaching on this and read in advance, that's probably why you're here. In fact, we had like record attendance at 9 a.m. Like, what is he going to do with this? I'm going to do my best. I would have skipped it too until I really got into studying. I'm like, I'm so glad of all the things that could have gotten cut out of the Bible that this one is here. So let me just read you. I won't read the whole chapter because it's a lot. I'll read you a few parts. We'll summarize the rest, okay? Then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law. So Judah is saying to Tamar, who I didn't write on here because she's female, his daughter-in-law, meaning she has, at this point in the story, married who died, and then Onan was given to her, and he died. So he says to his daughter-in-law, go back to your parents' home. Presumably, they lived a long way away. And remain a widow until my son Shelah is old enough to marry you. Just so you catch what's going on here. He is enacting betrothal. He's saying, widow, daughter-in-law, I have one son left, and I'm going to give you my word that when he's old enough, because she's probably about 15 at this point in the story, and twice widowed. Tough life already, okay? No kids. Twice widowed. Father-in-law says to daughter-in-law, go back to your parents' house, even though they're not expecting you, and it's really my responsibility. Go back to their house until my son Shelah, who is younger than you, gets old enough to marry you. He's asking her to stay a widow. He's saying, you're betrothed to my son, so you're not allowed to have sex with anybody else. You're not allowed to get married. You just have to live a widow's life until my son is old enough. Now, in parentheses, the author tells us something that we, the readers, know now, but Tamar didn't. And we're going to meet more of this guy. Let's find out what Judah's really like. But Judah didn't really intend to do this because he was afraid Shelah would also die, just like his two brothers. So we already find out this guy's sleazy. He's a liar. He promises to do what is right, having no intention of doing it. He's not behaving like someone who should be in the line of Jesus. So Tamar went back to live in her father's home. Fast forward. Some time passes. Tamar knows how old Shelah was when she went back to her parents' home. And she's probably doing the math here. And there's a certain time period in which she's expecting to get a messenger that her husband, who she has been promised, is ready to become her husband, to live with her as husband and wife, to provide for her, to protect her, and provide her with children. But she's aware that Shelah had grown up and no arrangements had been made for her to come and marry him. She realized she's been duped. And she's been sentenced to a totally dead-end life as a widow. No protection, no provision. And that day and age, if you didn't have a spouse and children, forget it. You were economically vulnerable. You were socially vulnerable. You couldn't go out and get a job. This is not a free market society. She was completely doomed at 15, and no other man would want her since she was twice widowed and already slept with two other guys. So she has a choice, accept the dead-end life or fight for justice for herself. She chooses the latter, and here's her plan. She changed out of her widow's clothing and covered herself with a veil to disguise herself. Then she sat beside the road at the entrance to the village. Verse 15. Her father-in-law just happens to come by, noticed her, and thought she was a prostitute since she had covered her face, so he stopped and propositioned her. If this is just your first time in a church in a long time, the Bible's probably very interesting now. Like, this is wild. It is. Yes, this is a father-in-law unknowingly soliciting his daughter-in-law to sleep with him. She knows who he is. He doesn't know who she is. And the story continues. Verse 24. About 3 months after this happens, what you need to know happened here is that he did ask to have sex with her, but he doesn't have any way to pay her. And the Bible goes there. What do you do when you want to solicit a prostitute and the man wants to have sex right now and he has to pay for the sex, but he has no money to pay for the sex? He leaves her with collateral. Says, listen, I want to have sex right now. I do not want to travel the whole way home to get a goat and come back. It's what the Bible says. So what can I do? And she is ready for this. And she says, he's like, all I have here is my signet, my unique ability to make a seal for signing contracts, which is tied onto a cord and onto a staff as one piece. So it's basically the equivalent of his wallet. I'll leave this here with you. You can hold it as collateral, and then I'll come back later and make the down payment. So this is what happens. Well, 3 months later, Judah finds out Tamar, his daughter-in-law that he sent away years ago that he doesn't think he's seen, she's acted like a prostitute. And now because of that, she's pregnant. Well, in his mind, this is great. He says two words in Hebrew. Take, burn. Bring her out and let her be burned. Now, you need to know, if you were betrothed to be married and you committed and you had sex with someone, that was considered adultery and it was a capital offense, but it didn't require burning because burning was a violent, torturous death. Take her, burn her. You hear what he's saying? There's a double standard here. She shouldn't be having sex outside of marriage, and because she has, she's guilty, even though it's okay for me to solicit a prostitute outside of marriage and have sex with her. You see what I'm saying? There's a sexual double standard here. This is the Bible. Here you go, right? But as they were taking her out to kill her, she sends this message to her father-in-law. She knows her father-in-law is pressing the charges. And what she doesn't do is say, I'm innocent. What she does is say, there's a second party that should be prosecuted here, and I have the identity of the person who slept with me. And she says, take this to my father-in-law. Could you imagine being the messenger boy here? She says, take this to my father-in-law. He's like, oh, this is your father-in-law's. It's like his fingerprint. She's like, the person who slept with me left this here. I want to make sure that he gets this so that everybody can be prosecuted here. So she says, the man who owns these things made me pregnant. Look closely. Whose seal and cord and walking stick are these? She knows what she's doing here. It's presented to Judah, verse 26. Judah recognized them immediately. This is off the rails what the Bible says right here. Watch. She is more righteous than I am. Sexual entrapment, incest, prostitution. She's more righteous than I am because I did the greater sin, is what he's saying. I didn't arrange for her to marry my son, Shelah. In so many words, he's saying her sexual sin is wrong, but my social injustice was more wrong, and my social injustice probably provoked her into doing this. And so in the grand scheme of things, neither of us are righteous, but on Judah's sliding scale of righteousness, he said she's more righteous than I am, and I'm more guilty than she is because I did social injustice. And in this situation, in the grand context, that mitigates some of her behavior because I pretty much left her with two bad choices. Either live a dead-end life or try and get justice for herself because I had the resources and the power and the opportunity to give her what she needed and I withheld it. I am more wrong than she is. What a nuanced statement the Bible is making here, right? Judah recognized it immediately, and Judah never slept with Tamar again, thank God. But it also means there was a change of character. Verse 27, when the time came for Tamar to give birth, it was discovered she was carrying twins. While she was in labor, one of the babies reached out his hand. The midwife grabbed it, tied a scarlet string around the child's wrist, announcing, this one came out first. And then the little baby pulled back his hand, and out came his brother. What, the midwife explained, how did you break out first? So he was named Perez. Now here's the cool thing. How did you break out? You know what Perez means? It means breakout or breakthrough. Same thing. So you see where we're getting, we have breakdowns, but we ultimately have a breakthrough. What in the world, friends? What in the world does this tell us about ourselves? What in the world does this story have to do with really anything? It's literally right in the beginning of the Joseph story, and Joseph's not mentioned in here at all. This is one of Joseph's brothers. But keep in mind, Joseph, though he did point to Christ in a lot of his behaviors, Joseph wasn't the one who carried the promised line. Judah was. And what we find out about this guy, Judah, is that he wasn't a good guy at all. Well, it's also a story of someone else, Tamar. And you find out she wasn't so good either. Because can we just clarify something? Is incest okay? I never thought I would answer that question publicly on a live stream. No. Biblically speaking, incest is not okay. Sexual entrapment? No. There is no verse that says, you know what? Live wisely before the Lord, and if you're not getting your way, trap someone sexually. No. Prostitution? No. Well, it's her body. She can do with it what she wants to. I know is the take here, but look at the motivation behind it. I want you to see very clear, the Bible's not saying Tamar is our example. When you feel like life has done you wrong and you're the victim of injustice, you can go after it in any way that you want because there are certain things that if they're done for you, all morals are off. That's not what the story teaches. What the story actually shows you is that God is still working his righteous overall, I'll use a big word, salvific plan to bring Christ into the world. He's decided he's going to use people, and the only candidates are broken and flawed people. This is not a story about if you live life good enough, God will use you. This is a story about how, in spite of our flaws and brokenness, God's grace breaks through into all of our lives, or else we'd all sink under corruption. This is a story about God's grace breaking through for Tamar, God's grace breaking through for Judah, God's grace breaking through in the birth of Perez in such a way that his plan for salvation is not derailed, even though the candidates are all unrighteous. Okay, that's a rough summary of what's going on here. This is not easy sledding, but we tackled a lot of the most difficult parts here. Let me just show you the three breakthroughs in this story. Tamar has a breakthrough, Judah has a breakthrough, and ultimately Perez breaks through. So breakthrough number one, Tamar's breakthrough. It occurred when she ultimately receives justice, meaning she received what was rightfully hers, and Judah ultimately, eventually, painfully, but in the end, humbly and appropriately, granted her what was rightfully hers. So now, in this family tree, if we just go back to it briefly, I gave you a quick rundown at the beginning of what God expected out of each of the, you know, each of the fathers in the faith here. Walk closely with me. Know my ways. Honor the covenant. Teach your kids to walk in my ways. Well, we get down to Judah, and the first thing Judah does that we learn about is he gets married, but he gets married to a Canaanite woman. And God said very clearly, don't marry Canaanite women. They are not outside of God's love, but he says don't marry them because the Canaanites did not serve and did not relate to God the way that the line of Abraham did. And in a marriage, if you have varied religious beliefs, it makes it difficult, even if you can emerge a peaceful coexistence, it makes it difficult to say in our family, we're all going to honor the Lord as the one who's sovereign over our life, even though 50% of the spouses here just don't buy in. So he marries a Canaanite woman right out of the gate, and she gives him three sons. And the first 10 verses that we didn't read tell us about Ur and Onan and Shelah. When he's old enough to get married, Judah finds for Ur a wife by the name of Tamar. And Tamar gets married to Ur. The Bible doesn't tell us a whole lot about Ur other than this. He was so cruel and so wicked and such a bad guy that early on in their marriage, he dies under the hands of God's judgment. Now look at this from God's perspective. If the end game here is for God to get a son from Ur through Tamar into the world to bring Jesus in, he's not helping himself by killing off the first candidate. That's how bad he was. We don't know exactly what he did or how awful he was. He was that bad that God decided to strike him dead. Then we get to this one, and this is the one that all of you were hoping I'd spend a lot of time on because you want to see me squirm. But there was a law in place at that time called the law of the levirate married. It was codified in the Jewish law in Deuteronomy chapter, it's either 9 or 12, I can't remember, it's in your study guide, but it's codified into law later. It was the law of the levirate marriage. Here's what it meant. God has always been deeply concerned about widows and those who are socially disadvantaged. It was all through the Judeo laws, their culture, their economics. He constantly said, hey, make place for the foreigners living among you. Make place for the poor. Look out for the widows. Those people in that society that lacked the basic resources that they needed to be accepted, to be functional, to have some level of decency and well-being, he wanted everybody within that culture to be able to have those things, even though they didn't all have them in equal degrees. If you were a woman in that day, education, if you're a man in that day, education back then didn't mean a whole lot. But you better have a spouse and children, period. That's how the economy worked. That's how everything went. You had a spouse, you had kids. So if you were a widow, that meant you were a woman and you did not have the ability to go into the workforce and get a job or have any income or economic provision. So if you were a widow and you did not have children to the husband, there is a law in place that said the father-in-law, number one, would protect the daughter-in-law. The father-in-law would provide for the daughter-in-law economically, and the father-in-law would provide for her another one of his sons for the specific purpose of providing children for her. So after Ur died, Judah up to this point honors the law, and he gives to Tamar Onan. And Onan's responsibility to his brother was to give his brother's widow children through him. However, the law also said that those children would not be considered Onan's kids. They would be considered the children of Ur so that his name could live on. So the Bible tells us that Onan didn't like that rule. But he was a fertile young man. And he was willing to have sex but not get her pregnant. So what he does is he goes in to have sex, and rather than finishing the act of procreation, he emits on the ground so that he can have sex with Tamar, but just not give her a child because he doesn't want to give someone children that can't be his. Well, that's evil. And that's abusive. That is selfish at the very least. And so God strikes him dead. Yeah. He wasn't playing. But now here's the reality. We've got one shot left to get Jesus into the world here, and it is Shelah. Judah knows this. I've got one boy left. Now, what does the law say? The law says these two sons have not given Tamar any children. Father-in-law is obligated by law to protect her, to provide for her, and to give to her another son to have children. And so what does Judah say? He says, Tamar, and what is it, verse 11? Tamar, go back to your parents' home. Don't stay at my house anymore. Go back to your parents' home. Out of sight, out of mind. Remain a widow, so you can't go back to your parents' home, a 15-year-old, and go find another husband on your own. You can't go have sex. You can't try and pursue having a family. I'm promising you my son, so you're now in a betrothal, and we spent a lot of time on that, and I don't want to keep you here until the sun goes down. But you can go back to last week's sermon and the two before that to learn about what betrothal meant. It was the same, you know, in the New Testament, the scandal with Joseph and Mary's pregnancy is because they were pledged to be married, betrothed to be married, but they hadn't yet consummated the marriage. So they had pledged to be husband and wife. Joseph was preparing a home for Mary to move into, expanding his parents' house. Mary finds out that she's pregnant, but during betrothal, you weren't allowed to have sex with the husband you were prepared for or anybody else. You had to remain celibate. So what he's saying is, you go back home, 15-year-old, and remain a widow. Don't pursue any other option to have a family or life. I will provide it for you when Shelah is old enough. Shelah is presumably several years younger than Tamar at this point. So what's he saying to her? He's saying, I think you're the problem. I think you're the problem because it says he had no intention to do this. Well, why does Judah lie? Because it tells right here, he was afraid Shelah would also die, just like the other two. So here's what it tells us. Judah says, I've lost one son, I've lost two sons. The only common denominator is Tamar. It must be her. She's cursed. You know what Judah won't admit? Maybe some of this is my fault. because I married a Canaanite woman and I shouldn't have. And God told my great-granddad that I'm supposed to teach my boys his ways. And these two boys ended up so wicked they act nothing like God. It's not because of my failure as a parent. It's not even because of their wickedness. It must be because of Tamar. And we do the same thing. How many times have you done something wrong? He said, I was having a bad day. Blame it on Tamar. We've invented words like hangry to get us off the hook for being mean. Have a Snickers. Life will be better, right? He's doing what we do. He's saying, there's a lot of bad stuff that's happened in my life, but it's not my wickedness. It couldn't be my son's wickedness because that would make us guilty and that doesn't feel good. Let me blame shift to Tamar. Therefore, I can justify treating her unjustly because now he's going to be a bad finder. He's going to build a case in his own mind. And some of us get this way. We rejoice when we find out something bad about somebody we don't like. Aha! I knew it. I knew they were bad. And this justifies my own opinions in my own heart. What Judah won't do at this part in the story is say, you know what? I'm acting wrongly here. I disobeyed God with who I married. I didn't teach my boys to live right. They became so wicked that God got to the point where he's like, they just seem irredeemable. They don't even want to be redeemed. He had to strike two of my boys dead because of their wickedness, not because of her. She's done nothing wrong. But he blames her and he sends her back home with no intention. Don't call us, we'll call you. Sends her off with no intention. He just literally, he would rather send her to a dead-end life than deal with his own sin. Some of us would rather other people bear the blame for our own nastiness than us just have a spiritual awakening and say, I'm at fault here and I need God to start cleaning my side of the street. So before we think that Judah is so far below us, look, well, it was her fault. They cut me off in traffic first. That's why I... Blah, 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 blah. Well, the referee said this to my kid. That's why I... Blah, 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 blah. Man, we all look for tomorrow all the time. We need to be starting here. What's in here? Well, that person just, I don't know what came out of you. Well, what came out of you was something that was in you that shouldn't have been there. Let's deal with that. What got squeezed out of you when you read that news? What got squeezed out of you? That's where we start. Because life will come along and squeeze that sponge of your heart. Whenever life squeezes you, what's really in there comes out. And in that moment, you're going to blame everybody else? Or are you going to start with yourself and say, I take accountability for what was in there? And it's kind of painful that it came out. So I have one of two choices. I can either deal with the embarrassment and the pain and the guilt and the humility of what came out of me, or I can just blame it on someone else. I was having a bad day, or they had it coming, or I just tell it like it is. That's one of my favorites. I just tell it like it is. Generally, people who tell it like it is can't hear it like it is. Right? Those of you that are laughing, you're the innocent ones, and the ones that were not, that are not, you're like, I don't like him. Pastor Tamar, I don't like you. It's a really heavy story. We have to have some levity every now and again. Come on, we're talking about a father-in-law who gets a daughter-in-law pregnant who's fronting like she's a prostitute. It's just a hard story to get through. And we get back in the story. So we see what's going on here. So Tamar, though, eventually, she's like, it's been 4 years. He's more than old enough. They're never going to send him to me. She's living in this village far away, and she recognizes he's just leaving me out here. He's not going to send his son. That man lied to me. I'm in my teenage years. I'm going to die. I'm going to go broke. No one's going to marry me. I'm going to lack the very same thing. Like in her day, having a spouse and a children is like having a basic education, knowing how to operate a computer. Now, if you don't have them, if you get into adulthood and you can't read or you can't fill out simple forms online, it doesn't necessarily mean you're doomed. But I'm just telling you, the reality is it's going to push you onto the margins. If you don't have access to basic education, if you don't have access to some of the basic things you need to be included, it's going to be very difficult for you to feel included and live with the type of life that just has a general sense of decency and well-being. And in this story, Judah has all the power and all the resources to make that right, and he withholds them. And the Bible shows you from here and the whole way through that social injustice is a big sin to God. When the people who have the resources and the ability or the power or the opportunity to help others say, I could help you, but I'm going to withhold it, that's an issue. It's an issue. And I realize I'm not going to make everybody happy, but this is not my opinion. It's what the Bible teaches. Because you're like, that doesn't fall into my political line. And I've told you, at the end of the day, conservatives don't think I'm conservative enough. Liberals don't think I'm liberal enough. I don't sign up for these things. I'm a Christian, a follower of Jesus. Look, my politics, Jesus doesn't fit into my politics. Anything I do politically has to fit into who I know Jesus is. And he doesn't neatly fit into any of these categories. Because, you know, on the one hand, he does... You know, the stuff that a lot of conservatives lean on about the sexual sin and the morality and gender identity and definitions of marriage, you know, we get that stuff in the Bible. We also get things like we should take care of those who are socially disadvantaged and economically disadvantaged and vulnerable through centralized programs. And so it kind of throws all of our party stuff, you know, upside down, right? And so I see this gospel as giving us a holistic understanding of God's heart for people. And it's difficult sometimes to make that intersect neatly with a government and legal systems. We can't always get there the whole way, which is why I don't swim in those waters. I'm just not cut out for that. I thank God for our elected officials, because that's a tough job to have. It's a really, really hard job to have, and they need wisdom to be able to parse through these things a thing at a time. I got off on a lane I didn't mean to get off on. Let me get back on this, because you don't need to hear my takes on that stuff. You need to hear the Bible. So let me get back to this. So anyway, we see the problem here. Tamar has to come up with a plan. She either has to do something difficult with the possibility of a better life, or she does nothing and has the guarantee of a dead-end life. That's not a good place to be. But those are the only two options she sees that she has. So she comes up with a plan, and it's pretty bold. Verse 14, Tamar was aware that Shelah had grown up. No arrangements had been made for her to come and marry him. So, here's all the action words. She changes out of her widow's clothing. She covered herself with a veil to disguise herself, and she sat down beside the road at the entrance to the village, which is on the road to Timnah. Judah noticed her, thought she was a prostitute since she disguised herself, so he stopped and propositioned her. "Let me have sex with you," he said, not realizing that she was his own daughter-in-law. So this is here. How do you think Tamar knew this would be a successful strategy? Because somewhere along the line she thinks, she hears her father-in-law is coming. She learns that he is now a widow. He's not married. And now that he has finished his time of grieving, he's traveling on business, presumably. But she assumes, you know what? My father-in-law would solicit a prostitute. How did she know? How did she know this would work? You know why? It was his settled pattern of character. She knows, my father-in-law, I know his weaknesses. And now, especially that he's not married, he's going to be looking for the comfort of another woman. She knows what will work. And so with this in mind, she disguises herself, solicits him, and as we mentioned earlier, he doesn't have currency of any kind to pay, but he leaves her with collateral, basically the equivalent of his wallet. Here's my walking stick and my cord and my ring that I use that's unique to me, that's my mark to authenticate all contracts. I'll leave this with you so we can have sex now and I can go home and get a goat and come back and pay later, which another story for another day is this is now the third consecutive line that a deceitful thing was sealed with something having to do with a goat, which is another sermon for another day. But it's a pattern you can trace through the stories if you like that stuff. Okay, this is messed up. It is twisted. And yet, it's strategic. Because Tamar now has the videotape. She has the list that she can play at a time of usefulness. And on the one hand, we're rooting for her. And on the other hand, we're like, I shouldn't be rooting for her. But I've got two choices and I can't root for Judah, right? This is the tension of the story, because it's like the heroes aren't really being heroic. But yet, as you read the story, you're like, but there is some nuance here. Because I can, even though I can see the wrongness of it, I can also try and put myself in her place, as uncomfortable that is, and saying, I can understand why she'd go after that, because she felt like that was her only choice or die. You got two bad choices. She's trying to make the less bad of the two. Okay? Do you at least see that? Yeah, that's hard. That's hard. Somebody's like, no, there's always a right and a wrong. Sometimes it looks like in her case there was two wrongs in her mind in this time. Okay, she's going after justice, and so she leverages the sexual double standard that we talked about, because she knew in Judah's mind, if he found out she had sex while she was betrothed, he'd try and kill her, but she also knew that he would have no problem having sex with whoever he wanted to, because he was a man from a good family. And she leveraged that against him, because she knew not only would he fall for the sin, but once he found out that he had done it, he'd call for justice. And this is what happens. Three months later, she starts to show. And people in her village, she confesses, "I'm pregnant." All we know of the story that gets out is she says, "It happened while I was a prostitute." Word gets all the way back to Judah. "Hey, Judah, you remember that old daughter-in-law of yours?" And he probably doesn't even want to be reminded because he might be thinking they're going to ask him to send Shelah. "What about her?" "Well, it turns out she's been acting like a prostitute and she got pregnant, and now he has his chance." And he says those two words: "Take her, burn her." And as she's being drug out to be burned, she sends a messenger boy back and says, "My father-in-law needs to know there's another person in this crime, and I don't have the name, but could you show these to my father-in-law?" Said, "This is the collateral that was left to me by the person who got me pregnant, and see if he can identify who it was." And he's presented with indisputable evidence publicly. Can you imagine the shame and the embarrassment? Here, Judah has solicited a prostitute, which was a capital offense. Not only that, it was his twice widowed daughter-in-law. Can you imagine the humiliation? And how he reacts in that moment is a single Hebrew word, shadek, which means just. This is the verdict a just would render when he would hear a case between two parties. One party would be ruled innocent and the other guilty. Judah looks at what he's done to Tamar and what she's demanding and realizes she was right. She has justice. He says she's just. She has justice on her side. Judah is basically saying, "I'm guilty of oppression and injustice." Let me give you a few statements that are tough, but we're mature enough, I think we can get this. Tamar was wrong, but Judah was more wrong. Tamar's breakthrough occurred when she ultimately received the justice and he granted what was rightfully heard. The Bible's take on what Tamar did is totally off the map. Does it mean that what she did was right? No. Does not mean that she's right. Judah never said she's righteous. He doesn't say she's guiltless and I'm guilty. Here's what he says: she's more righteous than me. She's not completely righteous. She's guilty, but you're saying, but I'm more guilty. She's done sexual sin, and that's bad, and that's kind of the conservative take. Well, look at the sexual sin that she did. He's saying, I've done social injustice, and that's kind of the more liberal take. And what he says is, my sin in this case overshadows hers because I pushed her into a situation that was desperate. One take is, it's her body. She was mistreated. This isn't a sin. She can do what she wants with her body. A more traditional take is sexual sins are bad and she should be punished. She did wrong. There's no justifying of it. No justifying. We're not calling what she did righteous. This is not the chapter on what you should do if you feel like someone's wronged you. Okay? It's not saying, thus saith the Lord, if you feel like someone's done you wrong, go trap them sexually, record it, and then play. Heaven help us. That's not what this is saying. Not at all. Yes, lots of Jesus needed here. Lots of him. That's not what we're saying. But Judah was the one with power here. And his sin against Tamar has mitigated the punishment due her sin. There's another place in Hosea 4 where this is addressed and explained that way. In some cases, what the Bible's showing us, let me finish this, a person who has been oppressed may do wrong things, and they're still wrong. And yet, we need to be understanding in the broader context of their overall oppression. Okay, let me give you a more relatable, maybe not more relatable, a more modern example. And you might have heard this illustration before. There's a professor driving his brand new BMW to work, and he's driving through a residential neighborhood, and he's speeding. He's moving pretty fast. He's running late. And he's running through this neighborhood when all of a sudden, as he's driving, a brick comes right through his front windshield. Shatters the windshield, brick leads in the passenger seat. He quickly puts a car in park, gets out, and he sees an 8-year-old boy who obviously just threw the brick standing on the sidewalk looking at him, and the professor, out of rage, runs over to the 8-year-old, and right before he's ready to seize him up, the 8-year-old says, Mister, wait. I'm so glad you stopped. My brother fell off his bicycle over here and he's unconscious and I don't have anybody to help me. You were going so fast you wouldn't stop, and so I had to do this to get your attention. Can you please help my brother now? Should we go around throwing bricks through people's windshields? Another question I never thought I'd have to ask publicly. I'm a parent. I've made all kinds of rules I never thought I'd have to make in my own house. It's a crime to throw a brick through someone's windshield. Period. Doesn't make it right. However, in that circumstance, can you understand it? Can you understand it? It's not your BMW. Can you understand it? Okay. Goodness sakes, you make me work so hard sometimes. I wear these vests to cover up the sweat from all the extra work. Do you see how nuanced and yet wise the Bible is? Doesn't call what she did right. But God, in this extreme, unusual circumstance, through Judah, takes a step back, and even Judah, the more wrong one, in his own words, in this situation, says, she has justice on her side. I wonder if I care as much about this kind of injustice as God does. I wonder if it's even on my radar. And my answer is, obviously not. I don't care or even understand this kind of injustice like God does. And I'm not okay that I don't understand it as much as God does. And so my prayer in this passage has been, God, help me to be an instrument of your justice and of your making things right through my life. But you're going to have to teach me. You're going to have to help me, because I don't always know exactly what that looks like. But I read this story and I say, I don't want to play the part of the Judah in the story. And I don't want, through my own ignorance, to create the Tamars in my life, whatever that may look like, with these seemingly impossible choices. I want to be an instrument of your grace. And I hope that you can read that story and say the same thing too. Second breakthrough that I see is the break. I'll hurry to finish here. These last two come pretty quick. The second breakthrough is Judah's breakthrough. He has a breakthrough here, because this story could go another way. Judah has a breakthrough when he has a spiritual awakening. He finds out what's going on. As she's being dragged out to be burned, she presents the evidence. And what he sees is, I've been given grace here. Because he's about to go too far. He's gone far. You know what he's about? He's about to burn this young lady. And you don't come back from that. I'm not suggesting it's not forgivable. I'm not saying you're irredeemable. But he's confronted with the evidence, and he could once again lie to himself, lie to others. And you know how foolish it would be, because everybody can see it's his wallet. He knows, and everybody knows, that he is the one who did this horrible thing. And sometimes life will confront you that boldly, and we'll still try and lie our way out of it, because we would rather put the blame on anybody else than have to deal with our own stuff. But instead, he did recognize by God's grace, and he says, she's more righteous than me. You know what I see here? People really can change. Anybody can change who wants to change, because God can change anybody. That is my story. That's my story. If there was ever a human being who walked this earth who needed change, it was me. And if there's anybody who's ever walked this earth who was just as brazen and unwilling to take responsibility for my own sinful stuff and my own heart and the lives of people that I was hurting, it was me. And unfortunately, the only way that it ever got through for me is painful confrontation and awakening. I've learned I don't do pretty well when people just tell me what's wrong with me. It has to be shown to me in a way that pins me against the wall and I can't get out of it. Maybe you're different. You respond gently in private in a Chris Tomlin song. Thank you, Lord, for pointing that out. For most of us, that's not how it happened, because we deny it. Thank you for revealing it to me quietly. I'll just deal with it privately in my heart, but what I really mean, I'm just going to kick the can down to another village and hope I don't ever have to deal with that. Well, and then out of his love and grace, God has to ramp up the accountability and the awakening. And it's painful. It's painful. For Judah to become the vehicle for Christ to come into the world, he first had to go through a very painful spiritual awakening. And for Christ to continue to come in the world through my broken life, I have to have my own painful spiritual awakenings. I can't make it without that. Judah and his family knew more about God and his ways than any other family on the face of the earth, and look what they were capable of. Just because I have the title of pastor, you have the title of Christian, you participate in a church, you do godly things, you read the Bible, you give to charity, you volunteer and serve, you treat people with love and kindness. That's in and of itself, without a relationship with Jesus, that's just a resume building thing. And my resume is always going to have flaws and blemishes. They fall short of the standard of Jesus. And anything short of that standard does not gain me access to a relationship with God. Instead, I need his resume. I can't ever make my resume on my own effort like that. The sin in my life that's most hurting me, and the sin in your life that's most hurting you and the people around you, is likely the one or the ones you can't even see, and you're not looking for them. Your only hope is that God, through the tomorrows in this world, will help you wake up to it. But fortunately, Judah stopped before he was lost forever. Let me explain this to you. What he's about to do is burn this girl. And after, if he would have done that, he would have been left with one of two outcomes. One, he either spends the rest of his life lying to himself about why he was right, or he recognizes at some point that he was wrong, and it poisons him and depresses him so bad that he's never the same again. You see, you go through with this, it changes you forever. But he stops just before he's gone to that point. I recognize when I pray for a suspect of a murder, there's dissonance in a lot of our hearts. I get it. I expect it. When Jesus says, pray for your enemies, who do you think he's talking about? He's talking about people you don't like. He's talking about people that you don't have good feelings for naturally. The only way I can pray for my enemies is if there's a love in my heart for someone where previously there was none. Then I see Jesus moving in my life. Because when I got saved, there was love in my heart. It's just the love that I produce. It's a love for people that, generally speaking, I approve of and are loving towards me. It's not natural for me to love people that don't love me. It's not natural for me to love people I don't like, who embody and oppose me or what I believe. And when you pray for a suspect, I recognize, we can pray for victims or for anything that comes up. You start praying for suspects, it gets a little, it feels less natural. That's okay. That's God showing you a vacuum he needs to fill, because you know what? He wants to save that person. Doesn't mean that they might not have to face justice for what they did or didn't do. He wants to save that person. So you have, at least in the case of a national story here, you have a suspect that at least as of today is still alive. Notwithstanding what's done, and you can't just separate a person from that, but part of my prayer is what's done is done. I can't reverse it. I pray this person's still alive. We know where, according to his testimony, we know where Mr. Kirk is. He's in the presence of God today. We don't know the condition of the soul of this person. And my prayer is the enemy wants to take him out and take him to hell. God wants to redeem him. I pray he's still alive. Before this goes even farther, will you give him an opportunity? How can you pray that? Because that's God's desire for him. And I'm a follower of God. And he fills my heart with his nature, not mine. I can't do that. Okay. That's a you problem. I love you. That's a you problem. That is you confessing with your mouth the darkness in your life. So my question is, when these things happen, yes, feel all the feelings. We are not going to have all the same feelings here. We are a multicultural, multi-ethnic, multi-generational, multi-political, multi, all the multis. Okay? We're all those things. But we are first and foremost followers of Jesus. That's what unifies us. So, hey, we got to have to learn how to major on the majors and minor on the minors. And you're going to have to learn to get along with people. You don't agree with everything about them. Show me one person. You don't even agree with you about everything. Right? And Jesus don't agree with me about everything either. There's some things in my life he does not agree with. My job is to align with him. So I got to surrender and cooperate with those areas. But when it comes down to stuff like this, God gave Judah grace before it went too far. And he took that opportunity. And there was a character change. You know how? He recognized he was no better than the people he despised. I'm no better than tomorrow. All along he's been carrying himself like he's better than tomorrow. He's like, I'm not only not better than her, I'm worse than her. Spiritual awakening begins when you realize you are just as narrow-minded as the narrow-minded people you don't like. I'm afraid to look at my email tonight and tomorrow. Again, this isn't my opinion. This is what Judah shows us. He came to a point where he's like, I thought she was the problem. I'm the problem. I'm the worst problem. When you're just as bigoted and prejudiced as the bigoted and prejudiced people you don't like, that you are just as outspoken as the outspoken people you don't like, that you're just as prideful as the prideful people that drive you nuts, you're just as greedy as the greedy people that drive you nuts, and that we're no better. That's a spiritual awakening. I can't look down my nose at people that aren't like me anymore because I'm just as broken and flawed. I'm going to clean my side of the street. And here is a guy who looks like, for all intents and purposes, totally irredeemable, and he has this spiritual awakening opportunity, and it's very painful. But he yields to it. He softens his heart. And he starts to change, and he finally starts to act a little bit more like one of his future descendants, Jesus Christ. We all have to be born again. We all need a start over. We all need the grace of God through the tomorrows in our lives to bring us to confront who we really are so we can be woken up spiritually and do great things. We've got one more breakthrough, and I got 3 minutes, so here it comes. It's the shortest one, but it's the one I was waiting for. Perez, the baby, right? Perez ultimately breaks through. Now, here's the thing. So doesn't look like Judah. I don't even know how this fits in a family tree, but there's a fourth son. And it is born to his daughter. I don't even want to write it on there. Perez. Name means in Hebrew, break out or break through. Tamar carries the baby to full term. Perez is born. When Perez broke through, both Judah and Tamar now become part, the historical record of God's righteous plan. Now, God's plan was righteous, wasn't it? Bringing Jesus in the world, righteous plan. Thank God for him bringing Jesus in the world. And yet, he names, through the gospel writers, names the people that had a part of this. You know, these people, part of God's righteous plan, you're like, oh, this one? I wouldn't have put that, even if they were in there, I wouldn't have kept that. I would just let a cousin know that, but not put it in the Bible. But can I read, how does Tamar and Judah point to Jesus? Both Matthew and Luke in the Gospels include a genealogy. They write out the names of the men and in some isolated cases the women that God impressed them to include for all of us in this righteous plan to bring Jesus into the world. Perez is listed as an ancestor of Jesus the Messiah. God took the son of this ungodly, messed up situation and put him in the family line of the Messiah, even though neither Judah nor Tamar were examples of godliness. Phil Naur is not the perfect person. Phil Naur is not the prime example of godliness, and yet because of Jesus, he put me in line. Can I read to you Matthew 1? Verses 1 through 3, this is a record of the ancestors of Jesus the Messiah, a descendant of David and of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac. Isaac was the father of Jacob. Jacob was the father of Judah and his brothers. Judah was the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar. They even put Tamar in there. They're included as a list of these righteous instruments that God used to bring Jesus in the world. And you say, oh, I didn't know about that. Let me put a microscope on each of those people. Let me do the character study. And you're like, ah. Really? It must have been a different Judah. Maybe we don't take this literally. Maybe this is Old Testament. Nope. These are exactly who they were. Tamar got her life back when, in spite of her sin, Judah called her righteous. Judah looks at her and says, yeah, you sinned, but you're more righteous than me. I got my life back when Jesus looked at me and said, in spite of your sins, because you're with me, you're righteous. You see? I need Jesus, and you need Jesus to look at you and say, hey, in spite of your brokenness, in spite of all your flaws, I have forgiven you. And I now see you as forgiven and complete and whole in me. And even though you're focusing on all your flaws and you're just part of a broken humanity, but I'm looking at you and I'm calling you righteous, and I don't want you to write your life off. I can still lump you in. I can still extract good out of your life, and I can use you as part of my righteous plan. Wow. How can Jesus have the right to say that? It's because he's the opposite of Judah. Here's the conclusion. Judah chose to punish others because of his own sins, right? He took it all out on Tamar for a while. Generations later, though, Jesus would come in the world through his line of descendants to make things right, and Jesus chose to punish himself because of the sins of others. You see the difference? Judas says, I've sinned, let me punish others to make myself feel better. Jesus says, I've not sinned, let me take others' punishment on myself so I can make them righteous. You see? Jesus still seeks to do that. That's still the way he wants to come into the world. Jesus still seeks to come into the world through the credible testimonies and the evidence of transformation in the lives of imperfect, flawed people like me and like you. So my prayer is, God, will you wake me up spiritually, even painfully if you have to, so you can continue to purify me from my own corruption, and you can set me apart to accomplish great things for your purposes. God still wants to reveal himself to the world around us, and it generally comes through the lives of people like you and me. Like Judah and Tamar, we're broken, we're flawed, we're imperfect. But thanks to God's grace, he broke through and saved me in spite of my own sins and my own imperfections. And now he lives inside of me. And day by day, moment by moment, he's transforming the way that I think and the way that I feel about him, about myself, and about others, so that I can be a credible instrument that he can use to inspire other people to walk close to Christ. So, tough passage, but you made it all the way to the end. Can I pray for you? Heavenly Father, thank you for mercifully allowing chapter 38 to end, and we have chapter 39 next. But I thank you, of all the things you could have cut out of the Bible, what a beautiful story to include. Lord, help all of us to be a little bit more aware of your concern for the literal and figurative widows and orphans and disadvantaged populations and people in our lives. Help us to have a better understanding of how we can work in surrender to and cooperation with your heart for that. But even more deeply, wake us up spiritually. Keep us awake. Lord, I pray for anyone who is here this morning or watching online or listening to a podcast who may recognize in this moment, I want to have the relationship that Phil talked about this morning. I want to relate to God the way that he described today. I want to know that I can encounter Jesus personally and experience him and enjoy him. I want to know that he knows I recognize my own brokenness and flaws and sins, and that I am repentant and sorry for those, and I am laying them before him today, and I am welcoming and inviting his forgiveness. I want God's Spirit to come and live inside of me and to start transforming me into a person who's like Christ. And I know that to do that, I need to surrender being the ultimate control over my life, and I need to give that control over to Jesus because he's Lord. Friend, if that's what you want, that is available to you today. In the book of Romans, the Apostle Paul writes that if you confess with your mouth that Jesus is the Lord, and you believe in your heart God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. That's it. You're saved by God's grace, which he's already done, in your faith, which he's even giving you right now. The faith you have to even believe this is a gift from God. And so what I want to invite you to do is, if that's what you want, just confess that to God. Just tell him in your own words and he'll save you. You might need, I know some of you are comfortable to do that right now, so go ahead. If you need like an example of what you could say, what you could pray, here's a simple example. Jesus, I want to be very honest with you right now. I recognize and I admit to you, I've sinned against you. I'm broken. I'm flawed. But I'm thankful that I'm hearing that there's good news, that there's hope for me. So I want to take you up on your offer to save me. Will you forgive me of my sins? Thank you for taking my punishment on you when you put your sinless life on the cross. And I have confidence to believe that you really can forgive me, because 3 days later, I believe God raised you up from the dead. You defeated the two things that I can't. You defeated death. You defeated sin. Please send your Spirit to come live in me. I receive your Spirit inside of me today. Help me mature and grow as your follower. I'm giving over control of my life to you. You're the Lord and I'm not, so I surrender to your leadership. Help me be the person you've always imagined I can be. Amen.
We hope you enjoyed the Echo Community Church podcast. If you prayed that prayer at the end of the message and began following Jesus Christ today, we'd love to celebrate with you and give you some simple next steps to take as you begin your new life with Him. Just email us at info@echochurchmd.com to let us know. If you'd like more information about Echo Community Church, you can check out our Facebook page or our website, echochurchonline.com. Thanks so much for listening.